it happened when I was 16. And it's like, if I, it's sort of like I say, like, if you just continue to dwell on that and like any of the other macro or microaggressions that you face as just like a student of color in an elite education system, you're just going to consistently be angry. And so that there are some things you kind of just have to move past.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast about film, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and today I'm going to be chatting with Kendra James. Kendra James is the author of Admissions, a memoir of surviving boarding school. I've enjoyed Kendra's work online, and she's been a previous guest on the Filmcast before, but I developed a much deeper appreciation of her talents while reading Admissions. It's a funny, witty, and poignant retelling of her high school years at Taft, a private co-ed boarding school located in Connecticut. Kendra was the first African-American legacy student to ever graduate from Taft. In her book, she details the profound alienation she felt as a student of color and questions how the adults and institutions around her and her fellow classmates failed in various ways. With all the controversy going on right now in the country around education and how and what our children are taught, Admissions feels particularly timely. So I hope you'll stick around for our wide-ranging chat about why she wrote this book and what it has to tell us about education in America today. Before we get to that, I, of course, want to always thank all the folks that make this podcast possible, specifically the folks at patreon.com/Dave Chen. Sign up at patreon.com/Dave Chen to get bonus episodes of me just talking about movies and TV shows and other fun stuff, as well as access to office hours, which is where I answer any questions you might have for me. I want to particularly thank the executive producer patrons. I'm thinking of Kevin Sow, Ian, Stephen Miller, Sid Yadav, Steve Austin, Dan Flanagan, Jeff Evans, and Mark Warner. Thanks to all those executive producer patrons, as well as the rest of the fine folks at patreon.com/Dave Chen for making my work possible. All right, let's get to my conversation with Kendra James, who was a founding editor at shondaland.com. Her writing has appeared in Elle, Marie Claire, Women's Health Magazine, Lenny Letter, The Verge, Harper's, and Catapult, among others. She's currently a producer at Crooked Media. Her newest book is Admissions, a Memoir of Surviving Boarding School. Find it wherever books are sold. Here's my conversation with Kendra James, and stick around after for our weekly recommendations. Kendra James, thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's great to talk to you. Congrats on the book. I start by asking a lot of folks this question, especially if there are authors. Why this book and why now?
I feel like the now was actually more in 2016, which was my 10-year high school reunion. And so I write about it a little bit towards the end of the book. And basically what happened was I went up there and usually my friends and I would be a little bit better about sort of coordinating and making sure that like some of us were there, even if it wasn't like a huge amount of us. But for our 10-year, for our 5-year and our 10-year, like we kind of just messed up. And so I was up there and I was pretty alone and I got into line for the parade. And the parade is like, it's a parade of classes. So everyone who has an anniversary on the 5 or the 10 that year lines up with their class. And I was standing next to this kid who I had not been friends with at all when we were at school, but we started talking and we really just got to talking about the people who weren't there. And in this case, we were talking about classmates of ours who had passed away. And during that conversation, I realized that he didn't know that one of my friends who I write about in the book, Mike, had passed. And Mike passed in a really bad way. It was a really unfortunate series of events. But it just like really struck me that he didn't know that this student had passed. And that then as I was like talking to other students, and I should say these were all white students, and as I was talking to them, like none of them knew that this kid, this black kid in our class had passed. And that just really stuck with me because these schools really trade on the idea of memory and nostalgia. That's like a huge thing for them because you do a lot of fundraising and like capital campaigning in the independent and boarding school world. That's how they have like these hundreds of millions. Some of them have close to $1 billion in endowments, and you fundraise that money and you get that money from alums and from parents, really by trading on the nostalgia of what it was like either when you were there or when you had entrusted your child to go there. And so memory is such a big thing. And it just really struck me in that time that my friends, who are all Black and Latinx, weren't really part of our classmates' memory. And it was that example. And then it was also just the way, and this does happen, I should say, at other high school reunions, like that feeling like when you go back and like people are just coming up to you and sort of like slapping you on the back and being like, hey, how are you? And you're looking at them like, who the hell are you? Like, we did not talk. Yeah. Like, what is going on here? And so like, that's not an uncommon reunion event. But because a lot of these kids had not really given us the time of day when we were there, it just really stood out to me, like sort of that, for lack of a better word, that fakeness. Mm-hmm. It just didn't align with what my experience had been. And so I just really felt in that moment that like, oh, we are not part of this institutional memory. And I wanted to make sure that we were, or that like some small part of the story of Black and Latinx kids are now, because this book has been published, we are part of the institutional memory, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. And I just really wanted to make sure that happened in some way, because it wasn't happening, I felt, organically.
I was struck by how in the book that you went into admissions, right? And you actually helped to sell people on the idea of schools such as the one you went to, Taft.
Yes.
And I'm curious, like, what drew you into admissions in the first place, given that you had a mixed experience in high school, let's say?
I think once you graduate from Taft, or any high school in general, you graduate and you do kind of instantly, as soon as you get to college, like put these rose colored glasses on. I think like nothing is as bad as it was when you were in it, especially if you have a much better college experience. And like, that's the thing. I had like this amazing, wonderful college experience. And I really think that that helped sort of like temper the process of dealing with any of the trauma that I had experienced at Taft, because Oberlin for me was just such an amazing place to be. So I had like sort of a rose-colored glasses sense about it. And I mean, really what it came down to was when I was looking for a full-time salary job after I graduated, I had started working as an intern at a Broadway talent management company. And I needed to get out of there. I had to get out of there for a variety of reasons. I was writing a little bit, but I didn't think that that could be a full-time viable career yet. And so really it was just cynicism. I was in New York and I said to myself, okay, what job can I apply for and like be pretty firmly positive I'm going to get? And for me, I was like, I'm Black, I'm a woman, and I went to Taft. I can work at any independent school in this city. Like that is like literally, because it was like 2011, 2012. And that you were starting to like, a lot of the schools were like really starting to push some of those diversity efforts to the forefront at that time, because like those waves come and go, like sort of like trends with these schools. And it was really on trend at that point to be pushing for like diversity, equality, and inclusion officers. So it wasn't called that then. I think it was still called like multicultural affairs. And so it was just like, I was like, I can ride this wave. And I did. I wrote it into a program, which in the book I refer to as Scholars Striving for Success. It really was just a matter of practicality.
Mm-hmm. But at some point, after selling up-and-coming middle schoolers and high schoolers on the benefits of an elite boarding school education or private school education, it seems like you started becoming disillusioned with this, right? And
yeah,
you started realizing that all of this was bullshit. Do you recall the moments or the time period where this first started to dawn on you?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I mean, there's one story, like one thing, very specific thing did happen at Scholars Striving for Success, which I haven't been sharing it just because it's really not my story to share, but it was just sort of watching the way certain students were treated, or certain alums of that program were treated versus other alums. That was very jading for me. And then also—
What's an example of that you're referring to?
So, I mean— It was a nonprofit program that I worked for. And like, biases come into play, favoritism comes into play. And so, like, even though we were a program that supported the thrust of the program was we took low-income students out of New York City public schools and put them into independent schools, either in New York or New Jersey, or the boarding schools in the greater New England area. And so, like, there was some favoritism that would come into play, just like with the administrators and, like, which students they would go that extra mile for. And it wasn't always the students that, say, needed that extra mile, because maybe they were from a family with more means than others. Or they had parents who were a little bit more equipped to sort of prepare them for that transition, because the transition between a public school in New York City and an independent school in New York City is so rough and so rocky, or can be very rough and very rocky. And our program really focused sort of on the academic catching up, like, because a lot of the academics of these schools are a little bit more ahead of the public school academics. So we focused on that, but really sort of that that social adjustment and that socioeconomic adjustment, and just like adjusting to all of the differences within the student body, I felt that we didn't always do enough of that. And some mm-hmm. students were getting more of that and some were getting less. I mean, and then like to be like, another just like a really concrete thing that always got me was I spent 2.5-3 years giving IQ tests to fifth graders, because you had to get a certain IQ score to get into this program. And like, we already know, I think, you know, about the general biases of an IQ test and like how that is just in general not a great way to test someone's intelligence. And then imagine that you're using that as part of a package to judge a fifth grader. So that really, I mean, that hit me hard after a while, just after a lot of time doing that. Mm-hmm.
And the combination of these things made you feel like, what are we doing this for? Am I really benefiting kind of society by doing all this stuff? Yes.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, watching us like take kids who, or like watching us take kids just because of an IQ score, or watching us, not that this was ever said publicly, but like hearing discussions about how certain races would needed to have a higher IQ score than other races to like qualify for the program. So it was just like stuff like that, that like really was like, it wears you down after a while. Mm-hmm. And then like a really solid moment for me. And this was the moment where I was like, okay, eventually I do have to get out of this profession as soon as something arises, was when I worked at my first school, which was in Southern New York. And it was a threes through eighth grade school. So it went from pre-K three-year-olds to the eighth grade. And if I or one other Black woman, there was one other Black woman in the administrative staff, and there were no Black teachers at the time. So if I or this other Black woman did not walk from the lower campus to the upper campus every single day, then the students on the upper campus, the middle school, would not see a Black adult all day who wasn't a janitor or a groundskeeper. Mm-hmm. So for me, like, that really was like the final moment of like, I certainly can't be at this school anymore. Mm-hmm. And I only lasted a year there. But I also like eventually need to think about like getting out of this profession in general.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So your book Admissions is about your time at Taft. And I'm curious how you would describe your time at Taft if you had to sum it up in a couple sentences.
Gosh. I mean, rocky and yet very instructive and necessary. It's hard because a lot of the stuff that I write about is like, and I use this word so often, but like it is, some of it like was traumatic. In some ways, I am thankful that I went through it there at that age rather than having to go through it in college. Because I think when I entered Taft, I was really insufferable. And I like write about that in the book. I was not the best or easiest person to get along with, because I had not been exposed to a lot of, especially like the Black, the full Black diaspora, simply because of where I'd grown up. And so I was like very insufferable, and it took a lot to get along with me. And I'm glad that my first year of Taft sort of broke me of that at age 15, 16, rather than having entered, say, college with that attitude. Like, I think that it was very helpful in that way. And then, of course, like, there were just, the academics were so much better than the academics at my first high school, my public high school back in Jersey. I mean, I got to take screenwriting as a senior. I got to literally learn how to hang lights in a professional theater and run a professional light board. Like, there's so much stuff that I simply wouldn't have been able to do, which I then carried with me through, if not just through college, like also through my professional career. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't have gotten if I hadn't gone through Taft, like with all the good and the bad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things you just mentioned and one of the things you write about in the book is how going to Taft was a very eye-opening experience for you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read from a passage from the book. Apologies. Oh, and thank you for letting me read to you your own words.
Yes.
But you write, quote, "My parents have evolved and they just wanted the best for me, but best is a loaded term. The trappings it came with were designed within constraints of looking at the world that would take me years to unlearn. I realized over 3 years at Taft that there was a whole diaspora of Blackness I'd never been exposed to, and I did resent that over time. I wish that I had at least been brought up with a specific understanding of code switching, or at minimum, to respect and use the unique vernaculars that Black people have cultivated across America, rather than being told that any hint of an accent or utilizing any sort of African-American vernacular was simply wrong," end quote. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about that? And it sounds like, as you mentioned, you know, you learned a lot about your own Blackness at Taft, and kind of, it sounds like from this passage, like resented how much you didn't know beforehand. So can you share a little bit about like what you feel like you learned at Taft in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always start when people ask me about this. I'm always like, my parents did the best they could, and my parents were a product of they were born in 55 and 56, so they were born like right after Brown versus the Board of Ed, and so they were both privately educated in high school. Like my dad went to Taft, so I was a legacy student. My mom went
you were the first African-American legacy student at Taft, right?
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
correct? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. To graduate. Yeah. And so my dad went to Taft, and my mom went to private high schools in the Bronx. And my mom came from, like, they were not affluent by like today's means, but like they owned their own home in the Bronx. They owned a store. My dad, after Taft, he went to Brown. My mom went to Smith College, and then they both went to work in banking, in Wall Street banking in New York City after they graduated. So like they were very, and then I should also say like my mom's mom had a master's degree. So like they were coming from a very specific path and a very specific time. And they had, when they had kids, they really had like that first opportunity, I think, in both of their families to like dream bigger for their children. And actually have a real sincere chance of like making those dreams come true than their parents and their grandparents had. So I think that plays in to a lot of what they wanted from me, for me. So when I talk about like not knowing a lot about like the full diaspora of Blackness, a lot of that is because like, so my public school in New Jersey, it was separated by the leveling system. So you could be in like level 2, level 3, level 4 in our classes. And level 4 was for the quote unquote smart kids. Level 2 was for the not so smart kids. Now, this system was definitely abused and used lazily by teachers. And so a lot of Black kids were automatically put in level 3 and level 2 classes, whereas like a white kid would be way more easily slotted into level 4 classes. And my mom worked really, really hard to make sure that I was always in level 4 classes, whether I deserved that or not. I should not have been in level for math and science classes. Like, absolutely should not have been there. But she made sure I was because she knew that it was easier for a Black kid to fall levels than it was for a white kid. And it was going to be harder for me to get back up there. And so sort of like the stuff that was projected onto me were the Black kids in the level four classes are like the acceptable kids. And the kids who are in level three and level two, those are the essentially the bad kids. And a lot of the kids in level four with me, we all spoke the same. We all sort of like dressed the same. We all like had the girls all had perms. We were all put together the same way. Our parents were all sort of like similarly educated. So it was just like, that was what I was subconsciously getting. Like, this is good and this is bad. And so when I arrived at Taft and I saw like everyone sort of mixed together, because at Taft, we were all really smart. And I will say, especially like the Black and Latinx kids, when you come from one of those programs, like Scholars Striving for Success, you've essentially done 14 months of after school educational programs and then two summers of summer school, like 5 day a week, 8 hour a day summer school. So like, especially those kids at Taft, like they were more prepared than I was and could ever dream of being, but they didn't necessarily look the way like my parents had projected on me that like, kids who were, let's say like, or I guess they would like kids who they wanted me to hang out with should look. So it was like a real or sound too. Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on that? Like, what does that mean when you say look or sound?
Like, God, I was never allowed to have, say, like extensions, like box braids, twists. I was allowed to have them once. And my mom complained the whole time. And the only reason I was allowed to have them was because I was going to Los Angeles to be on Jeopardy as a child. And she knew that my dad wasn't going to be able to do my hair. So she let me get extensions like that one time. But because she did not think that like any sort of like natural hair, she wasn't really equipped to do natural hair like a lot of people of her generation, because everyone just got perms or like hot comb presses. Like, but also she didn't think that it looked like presentable and respectable. So I never had any of that stuff. And like, I arrived at Taft and like, there were like, I remember being so overwhelmed just by the variety of hairstyles and like also genuinely jealous, because like I never had that experience as a kid of like, sort of like sitting at my mom's like knees getting my hair done. Like, that was not something that ever happened in my house. Mm-hmm. So I was just really jealous that like all these kids were able to sort of like express themselves visually in different ways. And then like with speech, I mean, it wasn't even like just an African-American vernacular thing for my parents. Like, I only recently have sort of started taking on a little bit of like a New York, New Jersey accent, because mm-hmm. even when I was growing up, like my parents were like, we do not say coffee, for instance. Like, we enunciate fully. Like, they really wanted me to have like that flat sort of Midwestern, what they would have called at the time, and they did call at the time, like the AT&T phone voice. Mm-hmm. That's what they wanted.
In the book, you describe it as a non-accent, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I come from near the Boston area, mm-hmm. and I never perceived myself as having any kind of accent, you know? And I think to this day, I would describe my accent as a non-accent in general. And it's weird when you first realize that, or for me, it's weird when I realized that it was a non-accent, you know, like that I had a non-accent and that was like actually a specific style of speaking. And it sounds like you kind of had maybe a similar realization. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have the non-accent realization until a little bit later on. And that's because like, I think maybe one kid once at like one point told me that I sounded white, and this was not even at Taft. Like, this would have been like maybe fifth through eighth grade, and I think it literally only happened once, but then like I internalized that and was a little bit like had like some neuroses around that.
Yeah. How did you feel about it? Like when you heard that?
I mean, I remember feeling like, okay, well, there's nothing I can do about this. Like this is just my voice. This is how I've sounded.
It's not like so you weren't like consciously trying to put on that voice. That was just the way you sounded, right?
No. I mean, if anything, I feel like the voice that I like, the voices that I tried to copy were like all just like from TGIF shows like that. But anyone from a TGIF show. So yeah, no, it was just kind of like, this is just what I sound like. There's nothing I can do about this. But if I ever, like my mom especially, like, and this was all definitely like, just because my mom was home, she didn't work. She was a stay-at-home mom. She was the one doing a lot of like sort of the everyday parenting. So my mom, like she was like quick to correct if I like used a double negative or if I like dropped an ending like on a suffix, like an ing or something. She was always ready with a correction. Mm-hmm. So this is just how I grew up speaking. And it was very strange to me when I got to Taft and again saw all of these extremely smart kids, like really bright, so talented, not just in academics, but like in so many other things. And they were just speaking every kind of way and in ways that I had specifically been told, like, you can't speak like this.
Yeah. Yeah. So it kind of allowed you to see, hey, it's possible to speak like this the quote unquote improper way and still be incredibly accomplished, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But it sounds like it wasn't all positive eye-opening experiences at Taft. There were two big incidents in your book that really stuck out to me. And one of them is when you were accused of stealing $20 from somebody who lived in the same dorm as you. And you had to have your case evaluated by something called honor court, which felt very totalitarian to me. But tell us about what happened. And you use pseudonyms in the book. So, you know, we should indicate that you're using a pseudonym now when you talk about what happened.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because I'm like, I try to, before I sort of get into it, I do like with everyone that I'm writing about, I do try to be like, you know what? As shitty as I was at 15, 16, like everyone else was also an adolescent. So like, I really did try to like extend some grace.
Right.
Just for that general demo, because who was perfect as a teen?
Right. But... So you're saying you use pseudonyms because you don't want to like call people out for dumb shit they did back then, basically. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Especially for stuff that like, I'm sitting here in my LA apartment and like I have worked a series of great jobs and like have a great life. None of this has affected me like some terrible, terrible way. But anyway, yeah. So basically my sophomore year, my sophomore spring, this one girl, Rachel, she assumed that I or thought that I had stolen $20 from her room. And so she basically came to me and she asked where it was. I said, like, I don't know what you're talking about. And she was like, well, I want to give you the opportunity to admit to it because I have a cop essentially in my family and they will be able to like run whatever fingerprints I send from my room. And she came to me with that quite like a few times over the course of a week.
Yeah. And she had already decided, she wasn't like going to 18 people. She had already decided that you were the one that did this basically.
No, I mean, and yeah, I can't say for sure that she never spoke to anyone else, but like she was pretty focused on me.
Right. Yes. So she was convinced you sold her $20. Yeah. And was making all these threats to you.
Yeah. And this was someone that I had been like pretty, like I had been generally social with throughout my time that year. But yeah, so eventually she was like, okay, well, this is your last chance or else I'm going to go tell the dean. And so she did go tell the dean and the dean called me into his office to ask me about it. And it really did feel like, and I always, since this happened, I have always assumed that he had made the decision because she had explained to him that she was ready to involve the police. Now, I don't know that for sure, but when I walked in there, like, it very much seemed like he had already made the decision that I indeed had stolen mm-hmm. this money. Mm-hmm. And so basically, because you mentioned this honor court situation, and Taft runs by an honor code, and it extends to everything from, like, on all of our papers and exams, we would have to write, "I pledge my honor, I did not receive aid on this exam, on this paper or exam." And then it also governs sort of like school social life, like, you can't steal, you're not going to physically hurt anyone, stuff like that. So this was technically an honor, a theft was technically an honor court violation. And so the thing about the honor code was, it was always said, if you just admit to what you did, you will get punished, but you'll get a second chance. Mm-hmm. If you deny it and we find that you have lied, a lie just sort of compounds the initial that incident of bad behavior, and then we'll have to expel you. Like, that, it was kind of a two-strike system. And so basically what I did in that moment was I made a calculation. And for me, it was like, okay, if I admit to this, I'm going to get suspended. People are going to be like, my parents are going to be like very upset, but at least I won't get kicked out. Because to get kicked out of an independent school, especially a boarding school where like your life is in that bubble, and that just is your whole environment and identity, your identity is like wrapped up in going to that school. And they do that on purpose. A, because they need to keep an eye on you and they don't want you like running all over Connecticut, but also like to, again, foster that sense of like pride, memory, and nostalgia once you graduate. To get ejected from that bubble really does feel like the end, can feel like the end of the world when you're a teenager, because it's, you know, at 16, that might be the worst thing that's really ever happened to you in your life. And also it to me, it would have felt really embarrassing because I had left my public school in New Jersey, and I had had other friends who had left from my friend group back home in Jersey, who had left to go to independent schools. So, and none of them had ended up back at Columbia, and I didn't want that to happen to me because that would have just been the height of embarrassment. And so in that moment, I was like, okay, this is the calculation that I need to make. And it made me incredibly nervous. I was still really upset. It was still just incredibly hard to go through, but it meant that I could stay in the school, get through the next 2 years, and just like keep it moving. So I made that calculation, and yeah, I went in front of honor court. And it's funny. It's like it's supposed to be a court of your peers. Plus like a few administrators. And I noted this in the book, like, I actually can't remember if there was another Black student on the honor court that night. So in that way, it's like sort of like a jury. It's like, you know, are these really your peers? Are these mm-hmm. people like understanding what you're going through in that moment? Are they understanding like what your calculations are here? All of that. But yeah, I don't know if there was a Black student there, but yeah, so I admitted to it. And I got suspended for a week. And then it was so crazy because you leave for a week and then you come back and it's literally like nothing ever happened. And so in that like way where they promise you that second chance, like Taft really kept its word on that. Like, it was never mentioned to me again. The only time it was mentioned to me again was in the college process when I had to write like a note about it. In my college applications to all the schools that I applied to, like mm-hmm. to explain the suspension on your record. And it's so funny. I think back on it a lot because I applied to something like 12 or 14 schools. I was only denied from two schools. One of them, totally legitimate. I had no business going to Brown, despite the fact that my dad had also gone to Brown. I was thinking I was going to be a double legacy, and that didn't happen. I did not have the grades for that. But I only didn't get into two schools, and I got into a lot of good schools. So I've always wondered if like people read that and it's like either A, they just like didn't care altogether, or they could just sense it was so fake.
Mm-hmm.
And I have always wondered that, and like what, how that played in to yeah. my college decision process.
Well, I was reading the story in the book, you know, I was kind of burning with rage, right? Because you're in the situation where somebody has accused you of something and you didn't do it, but because they have some set of like institutional, cultural, racial power, they're able to basically enforce their will upon you and force you to confess to this thing you didn't do. And it really is kind of a failure to me of the entire honor court construct, right? And
absolutely.
The idea that like somebody could accuse someone else and then just because they have vague references of having an uncle or someone who's a cop, like now, you know, Kendra needs to confess. It feels outrageous to me. And I'm curious how you felt in the moment. You said you made the calculation, you know, and like, but what is your feeling about it years later? Like, how do you think back on it? Are you like, man, that was really upsetting and unfortunate what they did? Or have you made peace with it? Like, where are you emotionally with it?
I mean, I think it stands out as, and I apologize if this was a question you were going to ask later. It definitely stands out as a reason why, like, I won't be sending my kids there. So like in that way, I definitely still think about it, but sort of like I was saying before, it happened when I was 16. And it's like, it's sort of like I say, like, if you just continue to dwell on that and like any of the other macro or microaggressions that you face as just like a student of color in an elite education system, you're just going to consistently be angry. And so that there are some things you kind of just have to move past. And that sucks. That's part of what institutional racism does, you know. Mm-hmm. It kind of just like forces you to have to choose your mental battles in that way.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, to quote from another passage in your book, which I thought was very vivid, you know, you say, quote, "Karen doesn't like the way Annie's hair smells, so Annie sent home with a note from the teacher telling her mother that she needs to lay off the pink lotion while braiding her hair. Karen's mother buys all the tights for the school dance recital that week, and even though they don't match her skin, Annie's expected to wear them with a smile. Karen and Annie turn in their papers at the same time, and Annie's accused of copying off Karen instead of the other way around, because Annie's paper doesn't sound the way she talks. Most of us begin dealing with this the very moment a white student enters our classroom," end quote. So it sounds like, you know, this situation with the honor court is kind of just another example of the things that you need to weigh that other students, white students, don't need to weigh, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I am just curious, you know, in the book, you detail how your parents were really disappointed in you because you had stole this $20 that you didn't actually steal. Now that you've written a book about it and sort of made clear that you didn't steal it, like I assume they've read the book. Like, what is their reaction to the story now?
Yeah, it's so funny. My mom read the book over the summer, and when I was writing that section, I was like, I was asking kind of like pointed questions of her because I wanted to clarify a few things before I sort of told her the direction that this chapter was going. The thing I really wanted to know, and I didn't get an answer from my dad, but from my mom's side at least, I wanted to know whether the dean had mentioned to her or to them that Rachel was threatening to involve the police. Because to me, that is something that now that I've worked with children a bit myself, and now that I'm like, you know, one day I plan to have children, that's something to me that would have set off a red flag. But
like if the dean had said, "We're gonna get the police involved," that would have been like, this is not the correct way to deal with the situation.
Oh, right? Exactly. Like for me, yeah, that would have set something off. And it's so funny. Have you been watching Bel Air?
I haven't. Should
okay.
I?
You know what? It's kind of like Gilded Age. I've just decided it's rich people vibes and I'm going with it. It took me, if you do watch it, sorry, this is an aside. If you do watch it, you should watch those first three episodes as a package. Mm-hmm. I just did the first two and I didn't really love it. And then the third episode, like really like got it going for me. And now mm-hmm. I'm just all in.
All right.
But there's a similar, it's funny because I was watching it and I said to myself, I think I tweeted, I was like, I wouldn't have been able to enjoy this show while I was writing the book, because Will is obviously like he's going to a prep school in Bel Air on the show, and he's a new student there. And they do a plot line on this reboot where they find drugs planted in his bag, and security searches him kind of like without without, you know, any
probable cause.
Yeah, okay. Without probable cause or due process, school security searches him and they suspend him. But the difference from what my parents did from what Vivian and Phil do on the show is Vivian and Phil go straight into the principal's office and they start asking like a series of questions. And it was so funny to see that because one of the things I said to my mom when we were discussing it, I was like, she wasn't sure whether or not they had mentioned the police to her. And I didn't get the answer from my dad. But she also said that like she wasn't sure whether that would have, you know, sparked any alarms. And I kind of get that, because where I grew up, like my dad was the mayor of my town for a while. Both of my parents were on like various like zoning boards and like planning boards and like very involved in local government. So like when my brother was getting up to his terrible business, like if he was caught like smoking weed or selling weed in the park, the police would just like bring him home. We knew the local police. Mm-hmm. And like we were pretty like, my dad was like pretty buddy buddy with a lot of them. So I think there's like, that's also just like another difference that where they just wouldn't have reacted in the same way. But I also think the passage of time and like the fact that we're in 2022 also may have altered their reactions. I guess what I'm trying to say is like 2003 parenting or 2004 parenting was just like very different than 2022 parenting.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but what was the reaction after reading the story in your book?
Yeah, I mean, I think my mom, like, believed me, like, without a doubt. And she was, like, she apologized. And it's, like, there was not a huge reaction, I would say. It was more just, like, oh, well, we fucked that up.
Fair enough.
I mean, yeah, and I think that, as I understand it, that's part of parenting.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, another example of a challenging thing you faced while you were at Taft is a newspaper article in the student newspaper, the Taft Papyrus. I guess it's like an op-ed.
Yes.
That was published. That was like pretty offensive, and I'll read a passage from it. It's written by a writer that shall remain nameless, but in the book, what do you refer to her as in the book?
I call her Emma Hunter.
Emma Hunter in the book. Okay, so yeah. She writes about a speech that one of the faculty members at the school gave, and she says, quote, "The easy conclusion is that white students and teachers made their African-American and Latino peers feel unwelcome. While this was surely true years ago, the situation is not the same today. Today, the barrier created between white and African-American students is as much, if not more, a creation of the students of color than it is that of their Caucasian peers," end quote. And I'll skip forward, and at the end she writes, quote, "The blame for the apparent segregation between black and white students should not be placed squarely on the white population of students. The discrimination that was alluded to is not present today. I've yet to meet a single racist, and if any Tafty were to discriminate against another, it would most likely be on the basis of gender rather than race or religion," end quote.
Yeah.
How much more convincing can you get? If anyone's going to discriminate, of course it would be because you're a woman. I mean, it's easy to look at this and, you know, to ridicule it because it's clearly somebody who's writing that doesn't know what they're talking about. But at the time, it seemed like it created quite... I could understand reading this as a high school student and being extremely upset by it, which is what you detail in the book, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I always say like that article, I feel like tells you more about Taft than I do. Like that article is like 700 words total. And it tells you more about Taft at that period than I do in 304 pages.
Right. And she's basically arguing that like the students of color are responsible for their own feelings of alienation because they self-segregate and they have all this social power. But really, it was like what, like a couple dozen of you at most, right? Like it's not
right.
It's not like you had a massive sort of far-reaching apparatus with a huge influence or anything like that. So yeah, so tell us a little bit about that reaction that you had to you and the other students of color had to that article.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the night that came out. I mean, everyone was talking about it instantly, which was like rare for a school paper article. Because we weren't, I mean, we weren't like, no one's following the papyrus like it's the New York Times. But everyone saw that instantly. And we called a meeting. So there were two student of color groups on campus at the time. One was TULSA, which was the Taft, the Taft Asian Afro Latinx Student Alliance. I think that, yes, I just got that right. And then United Cultures at Taft was UCT, and that was a group that where white students could join if they wanted as allies. We didn't have the word ally yet, but it was open to them. TULSA was for students of color only. So we had a joint meeting of those two groups that night. There was only one white student in the room, our friend, one of my friends who I did stage crew with, and I joke in the book, I still have the minutes from that night, and I was like, oh, she only spoke like four times in several pages, so like she knew that this was not her time. But yeah, the thing that stands out the most to me from that night was that I was the oldest person in the room. There were no teachers, there were no faculty advisors there with us that night. And I was turning 18 in January, but I was the oldest person in the room. And so it was me a 17-year-old all the way down to freshmen who could be just like newly turned 14. And that was who was basically in that room trying to solve the racism of a 100 plus year old institution. We had no aid, no help, and we had to try to not only like solve this article or come up with like a resolution or a response to this article by ourselves, but also process all of the emotions that having this written about us was making us feel by ourselves. We didn't have anyone there with us. And yeah, so that always just stands out. And I felt like it was very indicative of kind of like how we always had to deal with micro and macro incidents of racism from our white peers.
Did any faculty reach out and say, hey, like, hey, were you upset by this? Like, let's talk about it. Anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So Mrs. Gallagher is the woman who had given the speech that about the history of Black students at Taft. And so she had given a speech, and the article was in response to that speech, because the article apparently made Emma feel very uncomfortable, mm-hmm. that she was being asked to consider why Black alums didn't send their kids back. Well, okay, you answered your own question when you wrote that. But so yeah, she was very aware of what was going on, and she was very supportive in trying to help us come to some sort of resolution with that. But she was like kind of the only one, and she wasn't in the room that night. And so when two or three students did present faculty with a plan, a sort of like a moment of healing, where essentially they wanted the Black and Latinx students to gather along with white allies and anyone who wanted to listen to the discussion, they wanted them to gather in the Black Box Theater along with Emma, where ostensibly we would sort of like hash out our differences and like we could explain why this article was ill-informed and ill-advised, and maybe she would listen and there could be a dialogue. But Emma chose not to show up because she thought that the environment would be too hostile. And she was allowed to get away with that. Like, no one on the faculty made her come or made her really no one made her face any consequences, mm-hmm. For writing that article. And it's really interesting because I have found different versions of that article throughout the years in the papyrus. So it's very cyclical, I always feel like, these incidents at Taft and on other campuses of schools like Taft. Things are cyclical. They happen, and then there's kind of like a big upswell of response, especially if it looks like it's going to be a PR disaster, which is more common, obviously, now in the age of social media. but yeah, so there's
in the book, you kind of talk about how if that article is published today, it probably would have gone viral, and there would have been recriminations, and Taft would have issued some statement, and probably nothing would have happened. But then you say, quote, at least we would have had something, end quote, is what you write in the book. And I think you were upset that, like, there was not at least some kind of reckoning over this article that was so upsetting to so many students, right?
Yeah, no, there was absolutely nothing. And I think that sort of that nothing allows these things to become cyclical.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you also write that, on that note, quote, instead of really drilling down and doing the work necessary to examine the ways in which race, privilege, and class interacted at these elite institutions, they just agreed to things like inter-school dances instead, end quote. And I think you're commenting on, like, how these schools don't really address the core issues and instead use sort of surface level solutions to these problems. I guess I'm curious if you have any thoughts on what would an institution look like or what measures would look like that really address these issues at the root level, in your opinion.
I mean, for Taft, and I think they did recently, like very recently, like within the last year and a half, do this. There was no language in our student handbook specifically prohibiting incidents of racism, like, or specifically addressing what would happen to a student, like whether it would be an honor court or an automatic suspension. Nothing about, like, what would happen if you used a racial slur or if you, touched a Black girl's, like, hair without their permission. Nothing about that in the handbook. So when things are happening, like if a white student is using the N-word or if something else is happening, there the consequences that are being applied are consequences that might be applied towards, like, another situation that they would consider, like, equivalent, I guess. But there was nothing in the handbook that really specifically said to kids on campus, you will not get away with treating Black or Latinx children or any student of color, frankly, as less than. And that was true, like, through the greater part of the Trump administration, which, like, to me is wild. When you see, like, what is happening, like, out in the world, especially with, like, white men, especially when you have Roger Ailes' kid and you have, like, going to your school and you have Roger Ailes coming to give morning meetings, like, you really ought to have some language addressing racism and prejudice in your book, in your rule book. So that's, like, a big thing for me that we spent some time, like, the student alumni of color spent some time working on the school with, or not working with, but, like, when we sent a list of essentially, like, I hesitate to use the word demands, but it was like a list of demands,
requests.
Requests, recommendations. Yeah. That was a big one on there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I am curious, you know, what the school's reaction has been, if any, or if you've heard anything about the school's reaction, because here is an elite institution that prides itself on, taking good care of its students, you know, projecting an image that it takes good care of its students, probably projecting an image of being progressive and equitable. And you've written this book that is fairly damning about how you're treated at the school. And I'm curious, like, have they reacted in any way?
I haven't heard a singular word.
All right.
I've heard, like, from students. So after June of 2020, everything surrounding George Floyd, I write about it a little bit, but a lot of accounts started on Instagram. Like, if you type in Black at, and then you type in any school name, like, in your area, in any independent school name in your area, you're probably going to find an account called, like, Black at Taft or Black at Brearley or Black at Harvard Westlake.
Black at Taft does exist on Instagram right now if you want to go look at it.
It does. Yeah. Yes. So these, a lot of these accounts started collecting stories from Black students throughout decades, just cataloging the racism that they had to go through. So after that, the school did start having these sort of, like, quarterly meetings of alumni of color, meetings, like, of alumni of color separately, meetings with alumni of color and students of color, meetings with us and like various faculty members. So yeah, I attended a lot of those, quite a few, basically everyone that I could get to that didn't interfere with my work schedule. And I was pretty upfront with them in every meeting. Like, I was like, hey, before I start speaking, I just want to let you know I'm writing this book. Like, I'm like, you know, blah, blah, blah.
It's going to blow your mind when you read this book.
Yeah. And so like, and I talked about a few of the incidents, like including the theft. I talked about the article a lot because that was just like a concrete thing that is still in the school archives that like they can go look at. And yeah, so they knew the book was coming out. A lot of students, current students and like recent graduates have reached out to me to either like before it was published, like say that they were excited. I've definitely heard from especially Black and Latinx students post publication, like saying everything from like, thank you for writing this to like, I relate to that, like all kinds of like very kind and nice messages. But no, I haven't heard from anyone from the school officially.
All right. Well, I'm very curious what their thoughts on it are, because I think, you know, you have become part of the legacy of Taft. Perhaps not in the way they had originally hoped, but I really appreciated the book. And again, the book is Admissions, A Memoir of Surviving Boarding School. Kendra James is a founding editor at Shondaland and a current producer at Crooked Media. Her writing has appeared before at Elle, Marie Claire, Lenny Letter, The Verge, Harper's, and Catapult. Kendra, thanks so much for joining me today.
Of course. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Welcome to Weekly Recommendations, the part of the show each week where my guest and I recommend something you should check out. It might be a TV show, a film, an article, a podcast, a meal, a drink. This week, I want to recommend a new show on Apple TV Plus. It's called Severance, which is currently airing its first season. I think the show is incredible. The premise of the show is that there is a procedure that is performed on people at this office whereby they sever their work selves and their home selves. So your work self only remembers what happens when you're at work and they have no other memory of the rest of your life, whereas the part of you that goes home has no memory of work. It's a fascinating sci-fi premise, and it's explored beautifully and compellingly in an engrossing first season. It's one of my favorite first seasons of television I've ever seen. I binged the whole thing. The first couple episodes are available right now on Apple TV+. I just thought this thing was incredible. It made me think so much about life and work and what my relationship is to it, as well as the power that large corporations wield in our society. So I'd recommend you check it out. It's Severance. It's on Apple TV+. Here's Kendra's weekly recommendation.
The Gilded Age. I've just decided it's all about rich people vibes. And the best thing is, everyone is rich. The white people are rich. The black people are rich. It's just, I really love that show. I just highly recommend it. There is just something so soothing about like disappearing into that wonderful late 19th century world of New York City, with the pretty clothes and the amazing hats and everything on in the 80s on the Upper East Side, just looking brand spanking new.
Well, that's The Gilded Age, and it's streaming right now on HBO Max. Kendra, thanks so much for sharing that with us.
Of course, thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for us here today on Culturally Relevant. Thank you so much for listening. You can find more episodes of this podcast at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Email me at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. This episode was edited and produced by me, David Chen, and it was powered by Simplecast. Check them out at simplecast.com, a great podcast management and analytics solution. We got a lot more great guests lined up for you these next few weeks. I'm really excited. I've already booked these interviews, and I am looking forward to bringing you these conversations. If you listen and you want to support the show, there's my Patreon, but also just tell people about the show. Share about it on social media. Tell a friend. I'd really appreciate it. Thanks so much for listening. See you soon.